Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk, featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within 1 square mile of the West End. Today's episode is about Helen Mary Pickwode, a lovely lady looking for love, who fell for the man of her dreams. But owing to arrogance, incompetence, and a grossly unfair law, this love affair led to her slow and agonising death. Murder Mile contains harrowing details, which may make the uneasy quite queasy, as well as realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 36, Love, Loss, and the Lingering Death of Helen Mary Pickwode. Today, I'm standing outside of the Amber Hotel, 2 streets south of 35 Bryanston Square, where former Iraqi Prime Minister Abd al-Naif wasn't shot dead by 2 incompetent assassins. 1 street east of the Intercontinental Hotel on Park Lane, where he was. And 2 streets south of number 112 Bryanston Court, where Derek Thayer Lee Smith murdered his own mother over a matter of just a few pounds. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Situated at 508 to 540 Oxford Street, the 4-star Amber Hotel is a colossal 8-story Art Deco hotel from the mid-1930s, with brown brick walls, white metal windows, and a stylish curved corner. Originally called Mount Royal Hotel, its exterior has barely changed since its glory days. Situated as it was, at the back of the infamous corner house tea room, Maison Lyonnaise, where it is said the Blackout Ripper met his first victim. And as with most hotels, what happens behind the doors of its 684 rooms is none of our business. Whether they're full of randy couples rutting away, a horny teen bobbing his one-eyed warrior over 3 minutes of semi-sexy stroke teasers, a seedy Saudi businessman who, each night, has a new girlfriend who stays for only 58 minutes, or 2 pooped-out parents sodding the shopping trip and savouring a whole weekend of child-free silence. Ah, bliss. But one room has a very sordid history. As it was here, on Wednesday the 20th of May, 1942, that Helen Mary Pickwode died a slow and agonising death. being born on the 25th of June 1914, barely 5 weeks before the outbreak of the First World War. A brutal and bloody conflict which left millions destitute, disabled, and dead. By contrast, the early life of Helen Pickwode had no hunger, horror, or hardship. As being raised in an affluent middle-class family, the very worst that her upbringing could be described as was delightful, but dull. As the youngest of 5 children, all born to Alice, a devoutly Christian housewife, and Walter, a stern Scottish doctor, Helen was strong-willed and belligerent. But with her father's respectable profession being at stake, as much as their 3-story townhouse was an extension of his prestige, so too were his children. And as a necessary appendage to his status, at all times he demanded that they were well-dressed, well-educated, and well-mannered. And so, although they had food, clothes, and warmth, life was full of rules and routines. But being busy posing as the perfect family, what they lacked was love. As a pretty, petite brunette, with a big heart, brown almond-like eyes, and a sweet smile. Being a true romantic, as much as her parents ushered her towards the dreary life of a housewife and a mother married to a dull, loveless man, although she dreaded the stigma of bringing shame on her family, Helen dreamed not of wedding bells and babies, but of love, romance, and passion. By March 1940, aged 25, and still being seen as a sinfully single woman with no husband, ring, or offspring, Helen clung to the dream that one day her prince would come. And one day he did. And his name was Captain Tickle. Following the outbreak of the Second World War on the 1st of September 1939, as a well-educated young lady from a respectable middle-class family, Helen was conscripted into the war effort as a censor. Being based at the Postal Censorship Office in Liverpool, Helen was one of 120 censors whose job it was to intercept any letters, parcels, or postcards, steam them open, assess the contents, and black out any political, illegal, or morally dubious sections, which may prove detrimental to the war effort. For Helen, life was great. She had a good job, a solid wage, and lived in a 3-story, 4-bedroom Georgian terraced house at number 20 Canning Street in Liverpool. One room of which was rented out to a tall, dashing, and elegant army captain named Edward Tickle, who would change her life forever. Born on St. Valentine's Day on the 14th of February 1905, in the Irish capital of Dublin, Edward Gerard Tickle was a natural-born charmer whose chiselled good looks could lure any lovely lady and whose cheeky chatter could talk his way out of any trouble. Being loved and loathed in equal measure, Edward was an enigma. A man who some saw as either confident or cocky, appealing or arrogant, sweet or selfish, and no matter which, being born into wealth and privilege, Edward Tickle was raised with a high sense of self-worth, a desire to take what he felt was his, and all without any conscience or consequence. Having been privately educated at the prestigious Highgate School, after graduation, Edward began an apprenticeship at Lever Brothers. But being a trust fund baby and having no real reason to work, Edward jacked in the job and piddled off to Hungary to become a sheep farmer. By the outbreak of World War II, having enlisted in the Royal Army Service Corps, he was swiftly promoted to staff captain at the Postal Censorship Office in Liverpool, where he met Helen Pickwood. Based miles away from the prying eyes of her prudish parents, the longer Helen shared the same house as Edward, the more their love blossomed. But with Edward being an enigma, who was loved and loathed in equal measure, as much as Helen was besotted by him, and her best friends, Neil and Mary Barkler, were still undecided, Helen's parents disapproved. As beyond his confidence and his crisp captain's uniform, there was an arrogance about him they just didn't like. 1 year into their relationship, Edward's supervisor submitted a report to MI5, the British Secret Service, stating that Captain Edward Tickle had staunch political opinions, possibly fostered during those 2 years living in a Hungarian communist kibbutz, and that he required close observation. By March 1941, with Helen in floods of tears, Edward packed up his personal items, moved out of 20 Canning Street, and was transferred to the Postal Censorship Office, 225 miles away, in London. Although distraught, Helen knew that love knew no distance, that they were meant to be together, and that one day she would become Mrs. Edward Tickle. But what she didn't know about her beloved boyfriend was the truth. Captain Edward Tickle was married. In 1929, 13 years before Helen and Edward had met, Edward Tickle had married Renee Oriana Haynes in the St. Martin's in the Field Church in London. They had two lovely children and lived happily in Mill Cottage in the quaint Oxford village of Burford. But Helen knew none of this. To Edward, she was just a bit of fun. But being so besotted with him, Helen travelled from Liverpool to London every 2 weeks to see him. And yet every time she did, Edward ignored her, choosing instead to boast to his army buddies about the many affairs he was having behind his wife's back. As drenched in tears, Helen sobbed her way home. Throughout their relationship, Helen kept a diary. Sometimes she loved him, sometimes she loathed him, sometimes they'd break up, and other times she'd woo him back. But on Wednesday the 25th of June 1941, there was just one entry in her diary. It simply read, "My birthday." Nothing from Edward. On Saturday the 17th of January 1942, eager to reignite the dying embers of their on-off dalliance, Helen caught a train from Liverpool to Leeds to London, a deliberately confusing route designed to hide her clandestine affair from her disapproving parents. and with freshly coiffured hair, a poof of perfume, and wearing a pretty dress. She headed into the West End for a romantic weekend away with Edward. Having booked into the modestly priced Westway Hotel on Ensley Street, conveniently located just opposite Euston Station, Edward and Helen signed in as Mr. and Mrs. Tickle. They stayed in room 70 and both departed the very next morning. And although it seemed unimportant, that moment marked the start of one life and the end of another. Over the next 3 months, Helen wrote the following entries in her diary. Friday the 6th of February, 1942. No curse. Friday the 6th of March, 1942. No curse. And Monday the 6th of April, 1942. No curse. With her body swelling, a small bump in her belly, and having missed 3 periods, when Dr. Holmes confirmed that Helen was pregnant, she should have been jumping for joy, but she wasn't. As she looked down at her stomach, all she saw was sin, as inside her belly a baby grew, who was conceived in secret, fathered by a married man, and would be born illegitimate. And as much as childbirth would hurt, the greater pain she felt was a shame she'd bring on her family. And right then, Helen swore that if ever her parents found out, she'd stick her head in the gas oven. Confiding in her closest friends, Neil and Mary Barkler were a rock during this turbulent time, providing Helen with a safe place to stay, and in the warmth of their home, she could have a baby in secret. But in 1942, a pregnant woman had just 2 options. Have the baby and keep it, or have the baby and don't. Of course, there was always a 3rd option, but that was both illegal and dangerous. Helen tried several times to notify Captain Tickle of the swelling in her belly, but choosing to ignore her calls, letters, and telegrams, of the 2 replies she did receive, both were jokey and dismissive. When told of her confirmed pregnancy, he cut their affair short by replying, "Anyhow, we've had a good run for our money. We can't complain." So wanting nothing more to do with the baby, or Helen for that matter, as a privileged man with no conscience or consequence, Edward did as he always did and threw money at the problem. Racked with guilt, at the shame that her sinful shenanigans would bring upon her beloved family, on Tuesday the 12th of May, 1942, Helen boarded a train from Liverpool to London. And against Neil and Mary's advice, Edward introduced her to a doctor, whose name was George de Fossard. On the evening of Wednesday the 13th of May, 1942, in the Denmark Public House in Kensington, Helen Pickwood met the impressively titled George Frederick Montague de Fossard over a few light ales with Edward. To any outsider, nothing seemed untoward. There were just 3 friends chatting over a drink. Although initially suspicious of George de Fossard, an unusual little fellow, with a low whispering voice, a nervous shake, and blinking eyes which never met hers. As a 44-year-old German who studied medicine at King's College and had served in the British Army, although such a sordid business wasn't his usual profession, Edward assured her that de Fossard was highly recommended as an abortionist. Having pocketed £15, George de Fossard and Helen Pickwode popped off for a few minutes as Captain Tickle watched their drinks. To anyone else, it looked as if they'd scooted off to buy some ciggies. But as Helen casually stood there and inhaled her cigarette smoke, a very different deadly poison swirled about the four-month-old fetus in her belly, having just ingested 8 grams of ergotin. And now, the termination had begun. That night, although a little bit anxious, Helen felt fine. Having performed an abortion many times before, de Fossard warned her of the risks and side effects and assured her that the termination would take 4 days. Having swallowed the pills on Wednesday, by Thursday she would feel nauseous. By Friday, the deceased fetus would be removed. And with 2 days of bed rest as a precautionary measure, by Sunday she would be home, with her family none the wiser. To aid her recovery, Captain Tickle booked Helen into room 365 of the Mount Royal Hotel on Oxford Street. Obviously, he didn't book the room himself. He said he was far too busy, so he got a friend to do it. And although he paid for the room, in cash, he didn't want his good name sullied by such a sordid thing, so he had it booked in Helen's name. And of course, wanting nothing more to do with the baby or Helen, he didn't bother to visit. He just threw money at the problem and hoped it would go away. And although it can't be proved whether Captain Tickle arranged the abortion, although the man he'd booked had performed abortions many times before and had been arrested and imprisoned twice prior, Georges Frédéric Montagu de Fossard wasn't a real doctor. In fact, he wasn't a doctor at all. Born on the 16th of March 1898 in Buchenberg, Germany, to a British mother and a Russian father, it's true that de Fossard trained in medicine at King's College, but being broke, having quit after just 9 months, he set himself up as a plastic surgeon and an abortionist, having gained no qualifications. On Friday the 15th of May 1942, in room 365 of the Mount Royal Hotel, with her life in his hands, and dressed in nothing but a light pink nightie, Helen lay back on the dark green double bed, its colour coordinated to match the carpet, the curtains, the sink and the walls, in a shade about as subtle as surgical scrubs. Aided by little more than a handful of very basic medical items, towels, hot water, a glass funnel, forceps, and a length of rubber tubing. Although the operation was done without any anaesthetic, Helen felt only an odd twinge, as between her trembling legs, with no tears, no cries, and no squeal, she caught a brief glimpse of a little baby boy, barely the size of the doctor's hand, but fully formed in every way. And although her baby was perfect, already he was dead. With 2 days' food in the cupboard of the kitchenette, a bottle of painkillers on the bedside table, and a stash of sanitary towels to stem the blood flow, Defossard left Helen to rest. And there she lay, feeling alone and empty, in the echoing silence of room 365 of the Mount Royal Hotel. Her parents unaware, her boyfriend absent, and somewhere in London, the perfect little body of her supposedly shameful sin was being disposed of in a bin. And for the next 2 days, she cried, but not in grief. On Saturday the 16th of May 1942, at 8:40 p.m, a full 32 hours after the abortion, Neil Barclay received a phone call.
Hello?
After a short silence, the caller's voice cracked with tears at the reassuring sound of her friend.
Neil? Helen, is everything okay? No. The baby's out, but something went wrong.
And that's all the words he needed to hear. As a loyal friend, as his wife Mary watched over the kids, Neil caught the midnight train to London, and by 9:15 a.m, on Sunday the 17th of May 1942, Neil arrived at the Royal Mount Hotel. As all the while, Captain Tickle slept soundly in his bed. Inside room 365, the first thing Neil saw on Helen's sweat-soaked face was her sweet smile. And as he clutched her hand and gave her a big hug, she knew everything was going to be okay. But as he looked around her, the room told a different story. Everywhere, on every surface, lay a chaotic mix of syringes, swabs, and small glass bottles. As if in a feverish panic, an incompetent medic had wheeled his whole surgery in and injected her with drug after drug in the hope that one would work. And even though the overpowering aroma of methylated spirit stung Neil's eyes, it wasn't this medical smell which would forever be burned into his brain. A foul stench of rotting meat hung in the air. A fetid and putrid smell, so repulsive, it made Neil recoil and retch. As amongst the sea of bloodied sanitary towels and clumps of matted cotton rolls, which littered the floor, a swarm of flies swirled, making it look as if the carpet was crawling to escape. On the previously green bedspread lay Helen, her flushed face a ghostly white, and her brown eyes all bloodshot and red. As with a gas mask covering her mouth, she gulped great glugs of oxygen from a large metal cylinder. And although her baby was gone, still she writhed in pain, groaning and panting, her stomach all distended and swollen, as her exhausted body sat slumped amongst a sea of sweat, vomit, and brown vaginal discharge. Some new and fresh, some old and congealed. Neil tried his best to hide his horror behind a mask of hopefulness. But Helen knew the truth. By her side stood George de Fassade. Whatever he had done, he'd done wrong. And whatever he was doing, it wasn't working. As he scrawled down her fluctuating temperature on the back of a fag packet. And although he was unqualified, one thing he knew for certain. Although the baby was out, parts of the placenta were not. And of those bloody ruptured pieces which had remained within her, all had gone rotten, rancid, and septic. Helen was in serious danger, but unwilling to call an ambulance for fear of arrest, and believing he knew best, the unqualified doctor gave her more insulin, and for the next 4 hours, he did nothing. By 6 p.m, being drenched in sweat, Helen's heart rate erratically peaked at 200 beats per minute, twice its normal pulse, and with her body temperature being too high to record, suspecting that her death was literally hours away, de Fassade finally bit the bullet and called a professional. By 8 p.m, with Neil holding Helen upright, her scalding skin too hot to touch, she was taken to No. 15 King's Court in Chelsea, the surgery of Dr. Ernest Bloomberg, a widely respected and highly qualified doctor. Seeing her obvious distress, weakened state, and a stinking brown liquid oozing from between her legs, Dr. Bloomberg examined Helen in his sterilized operating room. Very quickly he noted a jagged tear on the anterior wall of her cervix, the telltale sign of a botched abortion. And with her body being poisoned to death by acute peritonitis, the doctor administered a strong antibiotic, a safe anesthetic. He carefully removed every piece of putrefying placenta and flushed out her cervix with 2 pints of strong detergent. By 10 p.m, with her pulse calmer, her temperature down, and her swelling subsiding, being pain-free, Helen's sweet smile had returned. And although Dr. Bloomberg couldn't prove that it was de Fassade who had incompetently performed this illegal abortion, he recommended that as a precaution, Helen be taken to the nearest hospital. By 10:15 p.m, Helen walked out of the surgery unaided. By 11 p.m, being too afraid of being arrested, de Fassade had driven her back to room 305 at the Mount Royal Hotel. And with the airless room being stiflingly hot and with the windows shut, the congealed vomit and caked blood had turned into a feeding frenzy of bacteria, flies, and maggots. On Monday the 18th of May 1942, after a restful night's sleep, Helen was feeling weak but well. On Tuesday the 19th of May 1942, being restless and sore, Helen's swelling had returned, along with the fetid stench of rotting flesh, and as she thrashed about, sweating and screaming, the brown liquid oozed from her nostrils. By 6:30 the next morning, having lapsed into a coma, 27-year-old Helen Mary Pickwode was dead. When informed of Helen's death, although Captain Tickle claimed to be upset, he shed no tears, said no prayers, and even though he was only a few doors away, at Maison Lyonnaise, in the Cumberland Hotel, he never entered the Mount Royal Hotel, or room 365, where his girlfriend was dead. In a lengthy trial, lasting almost a month, beginning on the 4th of June 1942 at the Old Bailey, both men were charged with manslaughter and conspiring to perform an illegal abortion. They pleaded not guilty. On Friday the 2nd of July 1942, 44-year-old German national Georges Frédéric Montague de Fossard, with his low whispering voice, his nervous shake, his suspiciously blinking eyes, and two prior convictions as an abortionist, was found guilty of manslaughter and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And 37-year-old Captain Edward Gerard Tickle, the natural-born charmer with chiselled good looks which could lure in any lovely lady, and a cheeky chatter which he used to talk his way out of any trouble. Although to the police his guilt was obvious, with Tickle having not booked the hotel room himself, having paid for the abortion in cash, and with no witnesses able to confirm whether he was anywhere near room 365 of the Mount Royal Hotel at any time during Helen's life or death, Captain Edward Tickle was found not guilty. And once again, being born into wealth and privilege, he walked away without any conscience or consequence. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. Don't forget to stay tuned to Extra Mile after the break. A big thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who get exclusive access to lots of secret and often rather sexy Murder Mile stuff, as well as a personal thank you from myself. This week, they are Susie Atkins and Gary Lant. Thank you, guys. You truly are super duper. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello? 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 Hello, friends. Welcome to Extra Mile. I say this every week, but there we go, let's say it. If this is your first time tuning into Extra Mile, this is me, this is Mike. I was just doing the bit you just listened to before. This is Extra Mile, this is the extra bit. This is where we dive into the episode a little bit more with a bit of a chat as well. It's unscripted, it's unedited. There will be mistakes throughout, so don't message me saying, oh, you made a mistake in Extra Mile. It does not count in Extra Mile. I can say whatever I like in Extra Mile. But what I do is it's off the cuff, and I dive into the episode a little bit more, give you kind of information that you normally wouldn't have listening to the early part of the episode. It's not compulsory. You don't have to listen to this bit if you don't want to, but people seem to enjoy it. And you know what I do as well? I actually find after the stress of researching and writing that episode and recording it, and the recording is quite stressful and the writing is stressful, this bit is quite cathartic. I quite enjoy it. This is an unusual sound. Normally, because I record in the mornings, I normally have a cup of tea, but oh god, that's good. Hang on, I'm having a beer. Why? Because normally this is my routine. Okay, so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I write the episode. I'm normally polishing it by Wednesday night. And then Thursday morning, I start recording. And then that gives me Thursday afternoon to do a real polish of the audio. Because if you're like me, you hate things like this. You hate and kind of the kind of mouth sounds that really annoys me. When you know, you can hear people's mouth move, and it just upsets me. So I spend at least a good half day going through all the audio, except on this bit, on the main part, and just getting rid of all the breath sounds and things like that. So so that takes me up to Thursday, and then Friday, Saturday, that's when I do the kind of the real edit of the show. I do kind of a run through it, and I work out where all the beats are, where the music's going to go in and out. I don't just throw music in, I plan it all. So I know how long each section is going to be. If it's 3 minutes 30, I will look for a piece of music that's between 3:30 and 3:45. And then I normally edit the audio around that. And all the sound effects and all that. So that takes me up to Saturday. Then Sunday's morning, I do Murder Mile, The Walk. And then Sunday afternoon, I start re-going through the research for the next episode so I can start rewriting Monday morning. That's my week. I literally don't have any time off. But this episode, jeez, didn't take 3 days to write. It took 4 days to write. And the last episode, the Iraqi one, in total, took 8 days. So yeah, I don't know why these are taking longer. Maybe I'm putting more into them. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely, as I was writing this, I said to myself, this is, because I overran with the last episode and the one before, I was like, this needs to be a shorter episode. And I kept saying it has to be 5 pages. 5 pages is about 35 minutes. But then I realised I was getting up to about, I got up to about 9 pages and I was like, shit. So I had to back off. I had to literally go through and start editing stuff out. Which is good. It's nice to have a more concise episode rather than a waffle. I don't like waffles, so I went through and I cut a lot of stuff out. But hopefully it's made for a better episode. But that does mean if I am running slightly over and these are like 8 days to do an episode, I may need to break up this season with some extra miles. But I was planning to do that anyway to get myself caught up with stuff. But I'm planning some really interesting murder miles this time. I won't go into them now, but, you know, they could be good. So, let's dive into this episode. This was the, I still would say, the murder of Helen Mary Pickwood. It was manslaughter and negligence, but... Do you know, it's just I'm sure that we can have murder by incompetence. I'm sure we should have murder by incompetence. They were just incompetent. There's a lot more incompetence in this. Incompetence and arrogance. Let's not forget that. There's a lot more incompetence that I couldn't put into the episode, but I will go into that very shortly. So if you're aware of this case, just for pedants who are out there, if there's anyone who is pedantic, Captain Edward Tickle, lovely name, isn't it? Edward Tickle. The first time I saw that, I was like, that's fantastic. But he's such a bastard. I didn't know whether to play that all the way through, whether to call him Tickle all the way through, because it's such a nice name at the start. You go, she fell in love with a man called Captain Tickle. And it's like, oh, you're like, oh, he's going to be nice. But he turns into a bit of a shit. And you're like, oh, I hate him instantly. He is a shit. And I did consider not calling him Tickle anymore in the episode. But then I realised the more I call him Captain Tickle or Edward Tickle, or I just call him Tickle, the less funnier it becomes. And I think that's kind of useful. It kind of, all of a sudden, you kind of get slightly angry at yourself for finding him amusing and his name amusing. And now it's like I hate him. Anyway, Helen never referred to him as Edward at all. He didn't like being called Edward. It was a name he really hated. He preferred to be called Gerard, which is his middle name. But for the sake of brevity and clarity, I decided to call him Edward. Or I never called him Gerard in this, except when we used his full name. I just felt it was better for clarity. So if anyone is a pedant and they know this case well, which I doubt, because that's the point of Murder Mile, is me trying to find cases that you don't know, that you won't know what the ending is, and it'll kind of surprise you. So for Bedance, she called him Gerard, he called himself Gerard. I decided to call him Edward, because that's his first name, and I'm sure it would have pissed him off, and that's a good thing. So both Edward and Helen... Oh, I'm going to have another drink. Oh, that's nice. It's warm, but who cares? So both Helen and Edward worked at the Postal Censorship Office. There's always been a censorship office as far as I know, but it was especially prominent during World War II. Or during any periods of unrest. So, or kind of any state, civil disorder or state of emergency, there is always a kind of a postal censorship office where the government can go through and they can examine your post. And just to check to see whether it's sensitive for any reasons, as mentioned in the episode just gone. So whether there's anything sensitive in there, whether there's maps, whether anything to do with troop movements, mentioning about places of military bases, or mentioning of anything political or illegal, such as abortions. So they were involved in that. There was different offices all around the country. There's one in Liverpool, which was the main one, but there's also one in London in the War Office as well, which is quite a fascinating job. I'd love to know more about this. One thing that I didn't put into the episode because it slowed it down, I took it out. When Georges de Fossard... Fantastic name, George Montague de Fossard. His full title is, oh God, what was it called? George Frederick Montague de Fossard, Comte de Vatan. So it's full title, so Count of Vatan. I didn't put all that in because it just slowed it all down. It made you want to concentrate a little bit too much on Georges de Fossard when really this was kind of Helen's story. But, so do you know I mentioned in there that he'd obviously failed all of his exams. He wasn't qualified in anything, but he set himself up as a plastic surgeon, which was kind of new in that era around the time. I think a lot of surgeons were developing plastic surgery after World War II, and especially it became very prominent in World War I, it became prominent in World War II. And because it was largely unregulated, a lot of people had set themselves up as plastic surgeons. So when Georges de Froissart, Captain Tickle and Helen met outside the Denmark Public House, just off Old Brompton Road. The pub is still there, but it's a kind of gastro pub at the moment. It's called Bimbles or something. Immediately opposite there is a very thin house at number 1 Clairville Grove. That was where Georges de Froissart lived. That's where they disappeared for those 10 minutes. They disappeared over to his house, which is where he lived, but he also had a full surgery in there. So I made slight reference to that during the episode that he'd brought his surgery across, hence the bottle of oxygen and all the syringes and the vials. He'd brought all that with him because he'd got all that kit there. But that was his surgery as well, which I find baffling. Maybe this is what he did, but with the abortion, why didn't he conduct the abortion in number 1 Clairville Grove, where his surgery was? Why didn't he do it there? Maybe he didn't want to. Maybe he didn't want her associated with his surgery, this kind of illegal act. Or maybe he felt that she had to, after the abortion, she needed to rest, and hence being at a hotel. But if that was the case, why did he usher her all the way across town to the King's Road in Chelsea to visit the other doctor? I know that was an emergency, but kind of a weird thing to do. So why didn't he use his surgery? Don't know. One thing that I had to cut out for time, and also because it slowed down the story, but it's equally fascinating, is, so, Helen had acute peritonitis owing to the... I apologise for the descriptions in here, but I felt we had to go for the full descriptions to, you know... I think I wanted you to feel what Helen would have felt, and it's, you can't, I don't think you can get around this by saying she was feeling slightly unwell and, you know, she had a bit of a dicky tummy. I think you've got to admit that there was brown discharge oozing from her. She had acute peritonitis. She was literally hours from dying. They decided to take her to Dr. Ernest Bloomberg over at 15 King's Road over in Chelsea. And he was that qualified doctor who was really great. And he was like, yeah, I can see what this is. It's a botched abortion. This is what we do, blah, blah, blah. And she started to improve. Like, within 2 hours, she was like, right, I'm back. Great. She just needs rest now. And then de Froissart took her back to the rather unsavoury and unkempt and unhygienic Mount Royal Hotel. And that's kind of where she died. The night before she died, so probably around midnight, she was starting to get really bad, like really, really bad. So, de Froissart decided to call up Dr. Bloomberg again to say she's taking a turn for the worse. Obviously, he didn't mention that he'd taken her into a cesspit of filth. Unfortunately, Dr. Bloomberg wasn't there. He was away on a call. So the call was rerouted to Dr. Bloomberg's father, who was Jacob Moritz Bloomberg. And what Jacob Moritz Bloomberg, or as they call him, Bloomberg Senior, what he would do is, when his son was away doing doctory things, the father would go, because the doctor, Bloomberg Senior, would assist. Problem is, Bloomberg Senior, I have to keep tripping myself up on this. I keep calling him Dr. Bloomberg Senior, but he's not a doctor. He literally was just a man who would assist his son in operations and things like that. So he really didn't know what he was doing, but he could do basic medical stuff. So this was about 12:45 in the morning, so maybe about 5 hours before Helen died. So de Froissart was there, Neil was there, Bloomberg Senior was there. He was asked to bring some more oxygen as well as some camphor. Helen was in a really bad state. She was barely conscious. She was drifting in and out of consciousness. She could barely speak. Her pulse was high. She was dying. That was the problem. Is it looked as if technically there were two doctors in the room, but neither of them were doctors. In fact, both of them had worked as assistants to other doctors, but they'd never been doctors themselves. And they were both given her injections to try and help her, and she passed away. She passed away around 6:30. She drifted into a coma, and then at 6:30 she died. Which is kind of really sad, really. If only the law at that time, because it was all entirely illegal. In 1942, abortion was entirely illegal. It wasn't until the Abortion Act in Britain of... it wasn't until the Abortion Act of 1967 in England, Wales and Scotland... I have to clarify that, it's not Britain, because Ireland has its own entire rules. After that, abortions were allowed up to the 28-week gestation period, but prior to 1967, entirely illegal. Hence, many women had to use backstreet abortionists, which is entirely illegal. It was done in an unsanitary way. The chance of death between of mother and baby was incredibly high, but you know, for some women, it was the only option, really. One thing that I couldn't go into in this case, which I thought was quite interesting, but I kept trying to put it in, but I couldn't find a way to conveniently put it in. Because obviously there's a lot of similarities between the Blackout Ripper. You know, you've got woman lying on a bed, blood emanating from her lady bits. This happened in 1942, just 3 months after the Blackout Ripper. So this was around the time that the Blackout Ripper was going to trial. And the detectives involved in this case were Divisional Detective Inspector John Freshney, Divisional Chief Inspector Leonard Clare, and Divisional Doctor Alexander Baldy, all who were involved, if you remember, in the Blackout Ripper case, which I thought was really interesting. Even though they'd already got Dr. Alexander Baldy, who'd done the autopsy, and he'd already confirmed, you know, they'd found the bloody forceps and they'd looked at her and they'd found that there was actually two slashes inside her anterior wall of her cervix. And they determined it was an illegal abortion. And because Sir Bernard Spilsbury, the Home Office pathologist, was passing through town on the way in to go to Paddington Mortuary, he popped in while he was there on his way, and he confirmed as well. He said, yep, this is an illegal abortion. So it was interesting that we got the same characters there for the Blackout Ripper. I would love to know what happened to Edward Tickle. As far as I know, he lived for the rest of his life in Hampstead in North London, which was kind of where he went to school, and he died in around 1967-ish. 1967 with the introduction of the Abortion Act. That's kind of odd, isn't it? Georges de Fossard, I don't know. I've searched, I've looked. He did serve his full 5 years. He didn't get early release for good behaviour. He left on the day. He did absolutely 5 years. Whether he was arrested again, I don't know. I did search. I couldn't find anything on him at all, which is really frustrating. So I hope that was interesting. Obviously, I've been... Ooh, drink time. Oh, that recording was awkward. There's a guy next door on a boat who's been playing some Shirley Bassey. I don't know how I'm going to edit that out. It's really annoying. I just kept wishing he would bugger off. You can probably still hear him now. Maybe I might kill him. with these... in these episodes, I've been asking you guys for questions. If you do have any questions, please do message me. I will answer absolutely any question. It can be do with the cases or to do with how things are, how I organise things or how I... etc, 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 blah, blah, blah. You can tell I'm tired. It's gone late now. I'm really tired. It's been a long day. So I have been asking for questions. I got one through on the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast discussion group on Facebook from Red Mustang. Fantastic name, Red Mustang. Much more interesting than my name. Red asked an excellent question on the forum, and I hope you don't mind. I thought I'd share it on here because it's really interesting. And the question was, Michael, can I ask? You can, actually, yeah. When you do your research, do you research multiple stories at a time, or do you research one story and then follow it through to the end before reaching researching another one. By the way, loved your Jamaican accent. Obviously, this has just come out after the second episode in season two, which was the Brian Alexander Robinson one. Hope you enjoyed that. I enjoyed doing the Jamaican accents. I apologise to anyone who was Jamaican. Red's question, fantastic question. Do I research multiple stories or just one at a time? What I do is I research multiple stories at the same time because I get easily bored. And also it takes a while for my brain to kind of work out what kind of story I want to tell. Because what I don't do is I don't just sit down and go cradle to grave. I don't just tell you the story. Because there's nothing more boring than just someone who's just going through Wikipedia and just telling you a chronology of what happened. Someone met someone and then they got stabbed and their head cut off. Oh, so boring. I can't be arsed with that. It's just really tired. What I like to do is find an angle. So with this story, obviously the angle for this, nice and simple, it's a love story between Helen and Edward Tickell. Obviously with the focus on Helen because she's the victim. With the Brian Alexander Robinson one, the Jamaican one we just did, I could have told it any of the ways. I could have told it from the victim's story, which, you know, normally I try to go in the victim's direction. But obviously with Johnny Howard and his friends being a little bit racist, I mentioned this in the last one, I just couldn't follow them. I wasn't interested in what they had to say, so I just didn't go that direction. So with the Brian Alexander Robinson one, because he was disabled, because he'd been abandoned by his mum, his dad had died. You know, it just made him far more interesting, and he was a black man in a racially motivated period of time, so it made it more interesting. But what I do is I research multiple cases, and then I put them aside. And then I go through them in my head and I try and work my way through them. I try and find the angle or the story or the side of it that I want to tell. And then when I've worked out what it is that I want to say, then I do that. That's what I do. What was that first episode I did? Oh, I can't remember his name. The guy who killed his brother and his... almost killed his brother and his sister, and then he killed his dad in the restaurant that used to be Primark. God, I'm tired. With that one, that was kind of... Although he was a mass murderer or a spree killer, that was really about his mental decline, and that was the angle in. It's about his mental decline. With the Jamaican story on part episode two, that was about, you know, racial motivation and a young man who hadn't got family and was standing up for those he believed were his family. That was the angle with that one. So with this one, what was this one? Yeah, no, this was the love story. So that's what I do. That's what I do with these episodes. I try and find an angle. And hence, I'm not really telling you what the next episode is. It's not to keep it a secret. It's because I don't know. I really don't know. In fact, I was just looking at my list of episodes coming up, and I already know what the 24 episodes are. It's just at the moment I'm rejigging them because some of them I'm like, I don't want to tell that story yet. And I'm kind of, you know, trying to work it out. Did that make sense? Probably waffling. I don't think that makes sense. So, should never record in an evening. After my original extra mile, the original ones that got me doing all of these, there's been a lot of people saying some really nice things online about the fact that, you know, I as a dyslexic, I do kind of struggle with not just reading, but for me, it's especially kind of reading and verbalizing. That's my kind of thing. I don't have a problem with the mathematical side of dyslexia, and I don't have a problem. I don't think I have a problem with reading and translating into my head, but I have a problem with the other side of it, which is it goes from eye to brain, which is fine, but from brain to mouth doesn't really work. Hence, I get stuck on words like who. I could spend ages just looking at the word who and saying My brain just can't process it. So that's the kind of dyslexia I have. So I thought I'd do some tips on what I've done over the years to battle it. Because, do you know, knowing I was dyslexic almost stopped me writing. I really wanted to be a writer, and I thought I couldn't be a writer because I was dyslexic. But you know, over the years, I've kind of learned to battle it and conquer it, and just make use of it as well. So I thought I'll give you all tips for any of those who are out there, or even if you're not dyslexic, do you know, there are some useful tips in there to help you if you've got to do public speaking as well. Because I've done public speaking. I used to do stand-up comedy and character comedy, and you know, write my own plays and things like that, which is a great way around being a dyslexic. You kind of learn to combat things through that. So I found out I was dyslexic by accident. Believe it or not, I didn't know. Because I've been diagnosed with a degenerative eye condition when I was about 12, and my eyesight was really going downhill really fast. And basically my eye specialist was like, look, if we don't arrest this now, by the age of 40, you're going to be blind. And it was like, shit, that was a real panic. All of my hopes and dreams had basically just disappeared. I was like, do you know, wanted to be a writer, thought, if you can't see a screen, what's the point? Was a photographer for a bit. Around the age of 15, I couldn't focus a camera anymore, and I was like, shit, okay, that's gone. Wanted to be a filmmaker, knew I couldn't be a filmmaker. So all my dreams were disappearing. So I spent many years trying to work out what it was I was going to do with my life. Because if you know that by the time you get to the 40s, you won't be able to see, what really is the point, really? So when I was at college, so 16 to 18, I was doing drama or theatre studies, as we used to call it. And what we'd have to do is we'd, every day, a book would come out, a theatre piece, and we'd all have to read in a circle. And basically our theatre tutor, Mr. Sandal, Rooty Tooty, we used to get given a book, and we'd go around in a circle and we'd all read a bit each, and he'd go, right, everyone read a paragraph each, and then we'd, you know, it's vocalising the drama. And after a while, I realised that he'd stop saying read a paragraph. He'd say read whatever you like. And then I started realising that he would start with the person to the left of me, and then he'd go clockwise. So he'd always, no matter where I was sitting, he'd leave me last. And I think that's because it was kind of embarrassing that I couldn't read simple words. I was really struggling by that point because I hadn't really worked my way around it. So it was then that I discovered that I'd actually got dyslexia, and I really didn't know what to do with it. Luckily, by the time I get to 32, I got a really good eye specialist who was really good, and he said to me, you know, if you let me do what I need to do, I think I can arrest your eye condition, and hopefully he actually said kind of, hopefully by the age of around 32, he said, hopefully I'll have arrested it, and then we can kind of move on from there. And weirdly, when I was 32, kind of, I'd go to see him every year, and I was, over all the years, I'd be looking at the chart, and like each year, like bits would disappear, and I couldn't read bits and bits. And then for 3 years, I basically got to the point where I was remembering. I'd be looking at the chart, and I'd remember like X, Y, Z, K, V, D, G, and I was like seeing the same words all the time. And I was like, and then all of a sudden, he turned around and said, "I think we've done it. I think we've arrested it." So my eyes aren't getting any worse, which is good, and that really helped. So by that point, I was like, okay, well, maybe I can start being a writer, because I hadn't given up on being a writer. I was still kind of writing in my spare time, like feverishly writing scripts away, hoping to write as much as I could before I just went blind. But that really helped me, because I knew by that point I got dyslexia. That really helped me work out kind of little tricks. So if you're dyslexic, or even if you just have difficulty with reading at all, here's my little tips. Number one, never read out loud. Now, I say never, but if you have to, of which I have to, imagine if I did a podcast and I didn't read out loud. That would be a really quiet podcast. My tip is to always rehearse it. So one thing that I used to do at the start, a lot of these recordings would take me far too long to record. because I'd be tripping over words. Whereas what I've realised is now is go through it a couple of times, rehearse it, just keep reading it and rereading it. And then this became even more important, rewrite it. And even if this is something that you've never written yourself, just write it up. Like if you have to read an extract of someone's book the next day or whatever, like some text or something, get your laptop out or typewriter and type it out. And actually physically typing it out helps your brain memorize the words. I find that really useful. So rewriting my own stuff really helps as well. And also when you're writing it, say it with your mouth. Now, I know that sounds really weird, but it's exactly the same way as like a footballer or a soccer player, as Americans would say. A soccer player doesn't literally just stand in front of a ball and kick it into a goal. It doesn't happen. It's literally thousands and thousands of attempts of kicking the ball. And by the time that he's learned how to kick a fantastic goal, it's because the football player knows exactly what angle and speed and timing, and it's all muscle memory. And what I've learnt with reading as well is it's muscle memory. So with this one, I didn't train myself enough for this one. So Georges de Façade, I had to practice that very quickly whilst recording this. I had to go Georges de Façade. It's a hard thing to say. There's also in there, I think they lived in a little Oxfordshire village. Try and say that. They lived in a little Oxfordshire village. It's like too many consonants to trip over. But if there's things that you find difficult to say, like Oxfordshire village, if you say it a couple of times, you can your lips learn to fold around the words properly. It learns to trip onto the next word. So I find that really useful. Also, if you've got to rehearse something, what a trick that I used to do. So I used to, when I used to do my Edinburgh plays, and because it was me on stage by myself for a whole hour, pretty much playing all of the roles, and it was to a pre-recorded sound effects track, so it had to be pin sharp. I couldn't miss a word, I couldn't miss a beat, I couldn't miss a microsecond, it had to be pin sharp. So in order to train myself to get it right, I recorded everything onto a tape recorder first, which I edited, so I took out all my stuttering and all that shite, and then you just play it back to yourself. So even like as I was walking around the shops, I would play back the speech that I was having to learn, and it's great because you're not concentrating on it, but it's going into your head. It's really useful. It's a very useful way to learn things, speeches, things like that. So there's some of my little tricks. If you get a chance, there's a really good book by Malcolm Gladwell, who does a really good podcast as well, called David and Goliath, The Art of Battling Giants. And in there is the story of, I can't remember the name of the guy, he's a guy, very, very dyslexic, like very dyslexic, to the point where the piece that Malcolm Gladwell has written about him is only 23 pages long, but he has said, I will never read it because it will take me 9 months. And he's not lying. It literally is. His dyslexia is really bad. But he always wanted to be a lawyer. And the problem with being a lawyer is you have to read lots of documents, and he can't read fast. It's like a line would take him about 5 minutes. So not only did he learn a way around that by getting people to basically pray-see it to him and tell it to him his face, but through his life, because he can't read, he's learnt to read faces instead. And he's now one of America's best trial lawyers. I'm trying to remember which side of trial lawyering he is. He recently took on a case which was against, it was either Google or Microsoft, one of the big companies. And in the first day, he got them to drop pretty much half of the case. Oh, it's litigation. That's what he does. He's a litigator. But that's what he does. That's his skill. And he's one of the best. So have read that book. It's really good. But also, other famous people who are dyslexic as well. Sir Richard Branson, owner of Virgin. I used to work with Nick who created Virgin with Branson back in the 70s. And he said Branson is massively dyslexic. You will never see him read anything. He has people read stuff to him. But he has a fantastic brain. He does everything in his head. And another person who British people will know, Americans might not know, is Ben Elton, of course. Ben Elton, who wrote pretty much the bulk of Blackadder, Young Ones, novelist, playwright, you name it. He's done it. He's massively dyslexic. And from what I've heard, when people used to get the scripts of the Young Ones off him, ready to perform, they would say they were illegible. You couldn't read them. But you knew that they were funny. And basically he gives his scripts to his, who's, I think it's his secretary, who's known him for years. She can read what he has written and she translates it into the real world, which I think is fascinating. Whew. So that was Extra Mile for this week. Hope that was interesting. Hope you enjoyed that. I've no idea how I'm going to edit this episode. I should really have finished editing it by now, but I haven't even started. And it's, what time is it? Oh, it's 10 o'clock at night. Oh my God, it's bedtime. So anyway, I'm going to sign off quick because I'm really tired. I need some food as well. I'm hungry. I lost my wallet last weekend. Yeah, at a concert. Yeah, I got a bit drunk. Lost my wallet and I lost my mate Rich as well. Sorry about that, Rich. Rich was trying to call me. I couldn't find my phone. Both of his phones were out of juice. Rich couldn't call me. I was at a train station up north waiting for him. He was at a train station in town. He slept in, he says King's Cross, but his text said Euston. Yeah, that was interesting. So I lost my wallet. So I've had no, and because I've got no ID, and because my, I got no ID and my signature doesn't match my original signature for my bank account, which I did 31 years ago. What's the chances of that? Your signature not matching. I couldn't take out any money, which means I've got loads of goodies to send off to Murder Mile fans. Hey, who've won the Murder Mile competition. I'm hoping to get my card tomorrow, but I've had no money, which means I haven't been able to buy any food. I've been living off what's in my cupboard, and I so want... Luckily, I've got a beer hidden away. Ha 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 ha. God, I'm hungry. I really am. I want some good stuff. So, I would eat a coot. I would so eat a coot right now. Coot update. I'm elsewhere. I'm heading north at the moment because I move around a lot. I'm in a place where there's loads of geese, loads of Canadian geese going back and forth. Also mandarins as well. Egyptian geese who are kind of sandy brown with a kind of an orange nose. They're really fascinating. And I saw some little baby ducklings today. They were really sweet. They were really, really tiny little. They were kind of not even palm size. They were really sweet. So... That's Extra Mile for the week. If you've this is your first time listening to Extra Mile, you're probably not going to tune in again. So that's me signing off. No one's still told me how I should sign off. You need to help me with this. I've no idea. That's why I'm waffling. So I've got a drink in front of me. I am going to raise a drink to you as I am now. I'm going to have a slurp. And that... is Michael from the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast. Tripping over my words. Michael from the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast. Signing off. Thank you and good night.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.